Visit Arizona. Time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment your work stress disappears as you kayak through the canyons. Or the moment you discover the life-changing effects of prickly pear chocolate. But nothing beats the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the very first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
But hang on just a second before you dial, because this frequently happens on Sunday mornings. All four lines are taken here as we go on the air. In order, we're going to visit with Shirley and Mark and Janie and Nancy. But, well, as soon as you hear me hang up on one call, that means you're 9 seconds late to be dialing in. But anyway, it's a nice Sunday morning out there. Just a great temperature, a little humid. Lots of clouds. Let's just hope the clouds do their things today and then move out by the middle of the day tomorrow so we can all see that rare event known as a total solar eclipse that should be the best we're going to have in many, many years across this part of Texas, across this part of the United States. And should be very interesting. It should be interesting anyway, even if the clouds don't depart. It'll be real strange to see it turn just black as midnight right in the middle of the day. But anyway, we're not here to talk about the eclipse and all the craziness that surrounds that. We're here to talk about gardening, and I hate to keep people waiting. Like I said, it's going to be Shirley and Mark and Janie and Nancy. Shirley is first in line. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning. I have called you, I guess I called you last week. I was talking about the yard that I'm trying to get redone, and we mowed it really short, and good. There's some bare spots.
Uh-huh.
Would it hurt the St. Augustine that's going to try to take over if I sprinkled the Mudagrass seed in the bare spots?
No, it won't hurt anything. In good condition, St. Augustine will dominate the Bermuda grass. I have to tell you, you're a little early to putting out Bermuda seed, because Bermuda is very much a hot weather seed, and we're looking at nights potentially in the 40s. You know, later this week. So my advice to you would be to wait a while. I usually say Mother's Day is about the time we begin planting Bermuda seed. How big are these blank spots that you want to fill in?
Oh, I guess maybe 2 or 3 feet areas. Pretty large spot.
Okay. Well, if it were my yard, Shirley, what I would do is I would fertilize. I would put a little compost down in those areas. The bigger spot, I would go to another part of your grass where you already have really good grass, another part of your yard, and dig up some little 4-inch squares and plug into that area. Then sit back for 30 days and let's reevaluate this right around Mother's Day and see how well the grass is starting to fill in those areas. And at that point, you can decide whether you want to add some Bermuda seed or not. If you were to plant Bermuda seed today, it's probably not going to sprout until Mother's Day anyway. So you're not gaining anything unless you're planning a trip to Europe or something and aren't going to be in town for Mother's Day. But I would, you know, give your St. Augustine a chance to really get started growing. Give it about another 30 days so the soil is really warm. And at that point, if you're not satisfied with how the spots are filling in, that would be the time to plant your Bermuda seed.
Okay. Next question. We have an oak tree that's kind of out in our pasture that the cows stay around a lot. Mm-hmm. And this year, it seemed to lose all of its leaves, all of the leaves. And I thought, oh, I hope it's not dying. Now, it looks like it's coming back. But the thick tree treatment, what kind of stuff do you put in the thick tree treatment?
Well, it's not an exact formulation, but basically it contains It begins with just the process of being sure the root flare is exposed. Now, if this tree's been out in the pasture for 100 years, chances are it is already pretty well exposed. But the Sentry treatment includes things like lava sand, and we always work a little bit of cornmeal in there with it, a little bit of humate, a little bit of compost. And, the formulation can vary, but if you go to dirtdoctor.com, you'll see the basic things that are in there. If you go to a good nursery, chances are you can buy the sick tree treatment already in a bag ready to go. They have gotten so clever, the folks at Maestro Grow that package this, because, you can't put cornmeal in and then bag it up and let it sit around for 2 or 3 months waiting to be sold. So when you open the bag of Maestro Grow Sick Tree Treatment, inside you're going to find a little sealed bag of cornmeal ready for you to mix in with everything else in the bag, and then you have everything you need right there to spread, around over the root zone of that big tree. If it's a really big tree, you may need 2 or 3 bags. But your tree is not unusual. Every live oak I think that I've looked at shed close to 100% of its leaves this year. In fact, Howard Garrett and I have talked about that a couple of times, that both of us have never seen a year when the tree so completely defoliated. But most of them, in areas where they've had adequate rainfall, they've already leafed out pretty well. In areas that are still lacking in moisture, they're like yours, they're a little slow to come out. So you'll never hurt anything with the sick tree treatment. But just know that your live oak is behaving, just like probably 85 to 90% of the live oaks across the hill country. And I don't necessarily think there's, any trouble. The one thing.
Okay, now we.
Yeah, well, just one other thing. If you buy hay from a source and you don't know how it was grown, a lot of hay producers treat their hay with this nasty chemical called picloram as a weed killer. And unfortunately, picloram passes through the digestive system of the cow and comes out in the manure. And that big old oak tree out in the middle of the pasture is probably where the cows love to go and lie down in the shade. And when they get up from their afternoon cud chewing or whatever they're doing, one of the first things they do is kind of poop around the area. And sometimes we'll see trees out in a pasture like that that are being damaged by the picloram that's in the cow manure. So that's one thing to be aware of. If you do indeed, buy hay from somewhere else, as I have to periodically, you might ask if you can, if that hay has been sprayed with any weed killers. If you want to do your own test, you can take a great big double handful of the hay, stick it in a bucket of water, soak it overnight, and then take that water and find a broadleaf weed like a dandelion or henbit or something like that. Pour that water over it and watch that weed for a couple of days. If the weed starts to shrivel and die, then you'll know that your hay has been contaminated with picloram. And I would do one of two things. I would either try to find a new hay supplier that doesn't use the picloram, or I would kind of screen the cows out, make them go lie down somewhere else underneath that oak tree, and give it a chance to recover. That's the only reason that I would have any concern at all about your big lone tree out in the pasture.
Well, we raise our own hay, but we do have it sprayed, so I'll have to make sure and find out what they spray it with. But now I have another treatment. You talk about putting cornmeal on. Is that the kind of, not just your plain baking cornmeal, that's your
so-called
cornmeal?
Yeah, agricultural or horticultural cornmeal. Your baking cornmeal is actually much lower quality than the cornmeal, you buy at the feed store, because what you're buying when you buy baking cornmeal, they've already polished most all the good things in the corn kernel away. They've taken that hard cover off of it, and all they've left is the starchy middle part. Well, most of the nutrients and most of the things that support the fungi and other things, good fungi, are in that outer part. So buy the cheapest cornmeal you can find. If you have to get it at the grocery store, HEB usually sells it as stone ground cornmeal. But what you want is just the entire kernel of corn ground up. Should be able to get it at any feed store. If you can't get cornmeal, get the corn chops like you would feed chickens or something like that, and that will do the same thing.
Okay, now, the trees in our yard are healthy.
Uh-huh.
Would it help to put Carmel around those trees, keep them healthy?
Well, it pretty much will prevent them from getting oak wilt and most other fungal diseases. If you don't have any oak wilt in your area, I'm not going to tell you it's really necessary. If you do, on the other hand, if you have neighbors with oak wilt or if you have any of it within 5 miles of your property, yes, it would be. It's kind of, think of it as a vaccine to keep your trees from getting it if you do it every 6 months or so. But if you're fortunate to live in an area that hasn't been impacted by oak wilt, I don't really think it's necessary.
Well, do you sprinkle it out at the drip line like you do fertilizer or just
you
around
can,
the whole perimeter?
That's what we did for years, and you can still do that. If you have any problem with wild hogs or things that come in, you can also get the same effect by soaking it in water. You put like 2 cups of cornmeal in a 5-gallon bucket of water, soak it overnight, and then just pour that out, normally within 10 feet of the trunk of the tree. Pour that water that's had the cornmeal soaking in it, pour that around, and that's just as good as putting out the raw cornmeal. Again, we used to always use raw cornmeal, but where I live in the hill country, we have such a horrible problem with wild hogs, and they want to come in and tear up the places where the cornmeal goes. So in my ranch, we soak it in water first and then pour that around rather than putting out dry cornmeal.
Well, I'm going to have some trees cut back at our yard out here at our farmhouse.
Uh-huh.
And I suggest to the man that he wait till it gets really, really hot to do it. And so he said, well, I don't think it's going to make any difference. And I said, well, I know, but I would like to do it that way.
Whether it's cold or hot or anything else, he still needs to paint every wound. If he's very careful that every wound, no matter how small or how large, gets painted, you can do it 365 days a year. But you don't go out and make 20 cuts and then go back and try to find them all and then paint. And you don't have to use pruning paint. He can use just about any kind of paint in the world. I think fluorescent orange would look a little weird, but it's just anything that seals those wounds for about 10 days will totally protect the tree from oak wilt. From little beetles carry the oak wilt, I should say.
Yeah. I thought I would start putting the cornmeal we have hogs out here too, around the trees ahead of time to make sure, you know. So how often do you need to do the cornmeal treatment on the tree?
If I had oak wilt next door, I'd do it 4 times a year. If I didn't have any oak wilt anywhere in the neighborhood, I'd do it once or twice a year.
Okay. And I got the information about the Epsom salts for tablespoons per gallon on rose bushes.
That will work fine. Even 2 tablespoons per gallon will help. But Epsom salts is just magnesium sulfate. It helps rebalance the minerals in your soil. It's great for roses. It totally stops blossom end rot on tomatoes. There are just a lot of good things. Epsom salts doesn't really benefit every plant out there, but roses and tomato plants are two that will receive great benefit from putting it out.
A friend of mine told me that if you soak banana peel in water and then pour it around your roses, it'll help them bloom better. I did that.
And did it help them bloom better?
The leaves at the top of the rose bush died.
Well, that's a new one on me. You know, bananas are high in potassium and lots of other good things, so I'm not going to say there's anything wrong with it. If you've got leaves dying on the top of the rose bush, it's probably due to some other reason, probably drought. But if you want to put banana peels around, you may have fruit flies to deal with, but you won't hurt anything.
Well, and I talked to you before about some Monterey oaks that had died in the front yard of a house that I have.
Right.
And I had one of them taken out yesterday, and the roots had not spread at all.
Yeah, that's a result of the severe drought and the extreme heat we've had for the past 2 or 3 years.
But there was moisture. This there's always moisture in this area because when it does rain, the water doesn't drain well. And so I've talked to you before about putting another tree, and you had suggested making putting railroad ties down.
Oh, railroad ties or some sort of anything you can make a kind of a raised bed out of. I like native stone better than I like railroad ties. For that matter, depending on the look of the landscape, you can just do what we call berming it up. You can just sort of mound the soil up in that area and plant the tree in the middle of your berm, maybe plant some other flowers or perennials around it. It'll look good, and it'll accomplish the same thing as you don't necessarily have to put a barrier to hold the soil in place.
Okay, now how high do you have to make the barrier?
I would say 12 inches.
Okay, sounds good. Well, I thank you very much for all of this good information, and I'll go to work.
It's always a pleasure visiting with you. Have a wonderful Sunday, and we'll talk again. You're welcome. Goodbye. I'll talk for a moment about azomite, and then we'll move on to Mark and Janie and Nancy. Azomite is one of the most remarkable products I've ever seen. It's a natural product. It's an ore that's mined in the western part of the United States and then pulverized to a certain degree. The magic of it is it has the greatest array of micronutrients and beneficial compounds of any substance that I know of. I call it, say it's like green sand on steroids. It provides a lot of different micronutrients, including iron and magnesium and the things that keep your plants really green. And remarkably, it not only keeps your plants from developing yellowing, chlorotic problems, it will actually cause the leaves on yellow plants to green up if the problem is due to a lack of nutrient. We've done this on periwinkle for their yellowing, done it on roses, done it on fruit trees. It's amazing what it does to green plants up and keep them green. And it just provides a lot of other beneficial compounds too. I make it a regular part of getting the soil ready for planting flowers or vegetables. I think it's a great thing to use as a top dressing around existing vegetation. And absolutely no negatives. It doesn't burn. It's not a chemical synthetic product at all. Totally natural product. You can work it into the soil or simply put it on the surface. If you use a finely powdered form we call micronized, it's actually so fine you can put it in water. You have to agitate it. Keep it. It doesn't really go into solution. It goes into suspension, but you can actually put it out with a hose and sprayer. I like the more granular form you just sprinkle around. But whichever form you choose, look for a fine nursery or garden center. It's great to prevent problems. It's also great to correct problems. It's Azomite for azomite.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and right back to the phone lines. Mark is next. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob.
Well, good morning, sir. Your hummingbirds back?
Yeah. we think we got up to about 800, which about what it's been. But what happens, there's a lot of mealy-blue sage around here.
Uh-huh.
And so once that really kicks in, then there's not nearly as many coming to the feeders.
Well, that's a little less sugar and a little less work for you, and not a bad thing. But I wondered, we're seeing lots of hummers, but I don't think we're up to our usual summertime numbers yet. So I just wondered what you were looking at. But that's not why you called me. What can I help you with?
Oh, first quick question. If I'm putting out granular azomite, how often would you do that?
If you don't have issues, probably once a year. If you have issues you're trying to correct, I do it every 3 to 6 months. It's not anything that'll burn, you know, it'll affect your pocketbook a little bit, but it's not a super expensive product or anything. But correctively, every 3 to 6 months, preventatively, probably annually is all you need.
Okay. I'll do that. So I found a really neat trick on pruning oak trees. You know, we have the oak wilt everywhere.
Right.
So anytime I cut even a little twig, I try to paint it, which is kind of a hassle with a spray can. I use a little squeeze tube of latex caulking.
Ah, okay.
You keep in your back pocket, and you just take it out, pop the cap off, and put a little dab on there and smooth it out, and it works much better for anything small.
Well, that makes good sense. And as you know, all you have to do is it takes about a week to 10 days for that wound to seal up. And as long as you keep those little beetles that carry the disease away for that period of time, you're perfectly protected. And that might leave you with sticky fingers, but it's better getting paint all over you, that's for sure.
Yeah, spraying a little twig with a paint can is a mess.
Yes, sir.
If I was going to try cornmeal again, we didn't have wild hogs for at least a couple of years because there has been no acorns since
right.
the ice storm 3 years ago.
Right.
But we have a flock back now, a sounder.
Right.
If you're putting it, mixing it and putting it as a liquid, are you pretty confident that won't attract the hogs?
Not nearly as much as raw cornmeal will. Blasted hogs will, it's just hard to predict what they're going
right.
to do, but it is not nearly as attractive, especially if you use it fresh. Now, you let it sit there and ferment for 2 weeks, yeah, they're going to like that. In fact, that's one thing
okay.
some of us do that, trap them. But if you mix it in the evening and put it out the next morning, very unlikely you're going to have any hog impact from doing that. But like I say, don't let it sit there and ferment or
yeah.
it'll actually attract them.
I think what I might do is experiment outside of our yard first because our yard is pretty much pig-proof, but I don't want to really attract – I don't want to tempt them too much.
Absolutely not. They are the scourge of the hill country. It's one of only two things I shoot on site, and the other one's porcupines.
Yeah, same here. They killed a couple of our little trees.
Right.
Okay, so I wonder if you're seeing the same thing, and we have a problem here. There's lots of things sprouting this year. Okay, the star thistle,
the
big purple thistle, the green
yep.
thread, the bluebonnets were prolific. There was lots of seeds that sprouted this year that have been there for years and
right.
on the ground.
Right.
So I can kind of handle this. Actually, about 10 years ago, there was a field of about 10 acres that was solid star thistle that we'd never noticed it there before.
Yeah, yeah. And the big old
anyway.
Russian thistles, too. And then we've
yeah.
been for about 4 or 5 years that you'd see an occasional one here and there. And this year, they are so unbelievably thick. And, in most cases, what we would be doing is just mowing them down low, but you want to let your bluebonnets go to seed. So this is a tough year. All we can hope for, I think, is, in the yard and places right around, I still go out with my grubbing hoe and just take them out one by one. But, on 100 acres of pasture, you can't really do that. But we just hopefully one of these days we'll be able to get this little weevil or little beetle that they've had pretty good luck with up in Montana and places up there that seems to target thistles to eat and nothing else. But why nobody's doing more with that, or at least not letting us know they're doing more with that in this area, I don't know, because so far as I can tell, that's a natural control like that is the only thing that's going to help bring these things back under control.
Yeah. We have about a 20-acre field and ranch behind us.
Uh-huh.
It's south of us. So when
yep.
they sprout, when they go to seed, all the seeds blow at us.
And they say one big plant can produce 500,000 seed. I don't know if that's true, but I know they sure can produce a lot.
So I've mowed the neighbor's field a couple of years.
So good for you.
Do you think vinegar and orange oil would knock them out? It's not that hot yet, though, now.
If you get them when they're young, absolutely. But the ones in my yard seem to grow about 6 inches a day, and I can go through the yard and chop out every one I see, and 3 or 4 days later, I've got another good crop back up. But, yes, if you get them while they're still down as sort of the rosette of leaves, haven't really started forming a stalk, it will do very well against them.
So do you think in the low 80s would be hot enough?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
okay.
we use it in the middle of the winter. Doesn't work as quickly, but it still works.
Okay. That's my only – I'm not – It's also a problem mowing this field because there's lots of rock rubble.
Welcome to the hill country.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay.
Preacher to the choir once again.
Right, right. And the ryegrass has just gone crazy this year. It's just taken over everything.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. Okay,
well, hopefully it's gonna make a good seed crop. So, we won't have to replant next year. I was looking at some of it and thinking, well, at least it's holding the soil in place, so if we get that next good rain, we're going to have minimal erosion. We've got such good cover of grasses, both weedy and otherwise, so I'm not complaining about the rescue grass and the ryegrass and things like that, because those roots, as they decompose, great organic material, and like I say, they're going to do a good job of holding the soil in place for what I hope will be heavy rainfall one of these days.
Right, but the stuff is in our garden rows, 24-inch tall ryegrass. I'm having to deal with it. Anyway,
that old push pull hole works pretty well against it.
It'll keep you busy. So, Pete's report, there's bad news. They were expecting a pretty good crop, and apparently there's only about 4 growers that haven't sold out to peach tasting rooms east of town.
Really? Uh huh.
But, wine tasting rooms.
Right.
At least 2 of them got hit really badly with hail last week.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And it's like they're not sure yet, but it's over half of what they had is probably gone or badly damaged. Yeah, so, if you're going to want peaches this year, check, early when they're going to have some.
Well, yeah. And the ones you have are going to be bigger and sweeter than ever, but I think Mother Nature's just a little irritated with mankind, and maybe she's right. Sending us a warning message that I wish a lot of people from Texas to Washington would listen to, but we won't go down that road. You guys get out and have a good day, and I hope you get to see the eclipse tomorrow.
Yeah, I hope so. Okay, good talking to you, Bob. All right, bye-bye.
Likewise, Mark. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. All right, let's get a quick break. Janie's up next. Looks like I get to talk about Rhonda's Nature's Way. And it occurred to me this week when I was getting a little bit of sniffles from all the oak pollen out there that if you suffer from all the pollen that's in the air right now it's oak and then it's going to be pecan, there's a real simple way to keep it under control for most people, and that's something called seasonal allergy relief. Rhonda introduced me to that several years ago. Fortunately, I don't normally have severe allergy problems, but they kick in sometimes, and I find that seasonal allergy relief is everything I need to feel better almost instantly. Of course, I visit Rhonda for many different things, for great supplements to help your immune system to head off a lot of problems. I'm happy to say I don't really suffer from sleep issues or much in the way of digestive issues, but if you do, Rhonda has natural things that will help you without the side effects and the interactions, medicinal interactions and things that you get with the products you get from a doctor. Rhonda has great supplements, too, to help you stay healthy, and she practices reflexology. I bought a gift certificate for a friend just a few days ago to give her, just to reintroduce her to reflexology. It's such a neat process. And Rhonda does Beamer light therapy, red light therapy, toenail fungus treatments, foot bath detox, you name it. Rhonda will have a way to help you naturally without running to the doctor for another prescription. Trying to lose weight? Let me tell you what, she has some things that taste absolutely delicious, satisfy that sweet tooth, but are totally free of a load of carbs and sugar. If you don't know about Rhonda's Nature's Way, get yourself over and visit her. She and her staff are there every day except Sunday, every week. Store is out in the northwest part of San Antonio. It's in the shopping center that's corner of I-10 and Callahan, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. If you want to feel better naturally, live better naturally, and especially if you're fighting allergies, how many more reasons you need to go see Rhonda's Nature's Way? I guess one other one I should mention is the Ultima. That's my drink for the summer months when I'm out sweating a whole lot and need to keep my electrolytes up. Lots of flavor, lots of electrolytes without any sugar. Just one more reason to go see Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, let's get right back to phone calls. Janie, Nancy, Ernest, and Cynthia. Janie's next in line. Good morning, Janie.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I got questions to ask you, and they're not going to sound funny. Anyway, I just heard you talk to a lady about her rose bushes, about something to make it better, prettier, the roses. What was that?
It was Epsom salts, just the plain old, cheapo, common Epsom salts you get at the grocery store. I normally mix like 2 tablespoons. She was suggesting 4 tablespoons per gallon, but just dissolve your Epsom salts in water. Water your roses with that. Now, you're probably a good enough gardener. Your roses are already doing pretty well. But a little bit of Epsom salt just seems to make the color better and just give the plants a little more vigor.
I'm sorry to ask you, but how do you spell Epsom salt?
E is in Edward, P is in Paul. E-P-S-O-M.
M. Okay. Got another question. I've got a rose bush that I bought yesterday, and it's a orange rose okay?
Okay.
And I wonder, do you have to treat it different, the one that looks like orange?
No, not at all. Not at all. It probably is a grafted rose if it's one of the, you know, bigger, prettier ones, and hopefully it's grafted on the right rootstock. I always advise people to stay away from roses from Tyler or Lindale. I mean, I was born in Tyler, Texas. I've got nothing against Tyler, but they use a different rootstock in that part of Texas. If you get from one of the California companies like Weeks or Armstrong or Jackson Perkins, they use a rootstock that grows much better in this area. So even if you get it, you know, other than at a nursery, it's always good to look and see where it came from. But if you've got a pretty orange rose, and it's no telling which one it is. There are several of them out there. My favorite happens to be one called Cinco de Mayo that's sort of a orangey, smoky, rosy color, but treat it just like you would any other rose bush. Lots of sun, regular water, and plenty of fertilizer, and little Epsom salts won't hurt a thing.
Epsom salt. Okay, I got another question, and this is stupid. Me. I was watering
Never.
My little plant. Okay. And I forgot to turn off that water. And it's been like 10 hours. My husband told me this morning. And I said, oh, is there got to be something to remind me that I have the water hose going?
There are about the only thing that I can tell you that is a good way to avoid that. And don't feel bad. We've all done that at one time or another, and it can sure bump up your water bill. No, don't ask me about that. I think I wasted $100 worth of water one night when I'd moved into a different house and I wanted to really water things thoroughly. But one thing you can do, there are little devices that you can put between the hydrant and the hose and set it for how long you want it to run. You can set it to run for an hour, and then it'll all cut off automatically. If you remember to go turn the hydrant off before then, all the better. But that's about the only thing that comes to mind that would automatically shut it off if you forget to. And you can just set it for how long you want the water to run. That would be, that'd be the about the best I could think of.
What does it do, turn off the water or ring or what?
Well, it shuts off. It's just a little device that, and people will like screw this onto the hydrant, then put their hose on it, and then go set their sprinkler out in the yard or wherever, turn it on, and it cuts off automatically after 45 minutes or an hour or whatever else. In your case, you just, you know, set it. You want to say, man, I hope I don't forget, but I know I'm not going to be watering for more than an hour. Set it to stay on for an hour and go out and do your watering. And if you forget to turn it off, it'll turn it off for you after an hour.
Where do you get that at?
I would try a good hardware store. That doesn't mean Home Depot, although they might have them. But a good Ace Hardware or Do It Best, maybe even a feed store, you might ask. They've been around for an awful long time. I remember my grandfather used them, and we won't talk about how long ago that was. But I would expect that any good hardware store would have it or could get it for you.
Okay. Well, you helped me a lot. Thank you very much. Okay.
Always a pleasure to hear your voice, Janie. You get out and have a great weekend, and I will move along here and talk to Nancy. Good morning, Nancy.
Yes. Morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a Monterey oak in the back. It's probably 24 years old, but during the freeze, it had some pretty large dead branches. Most of them fell in the wind.
Right.
I have one, and I just cut down a small one, and it had a lot of carpenter ants in it, mm-hmm. and the other one's pretty thick. How important is it to cut that out of your tree?
Not. It doesn't really make any difference so long as it's not likely to fall and, you know, land on you or a vehicle or a picnic table or something like that. Ultimately, it's going to break and fall out. But, I mean, if it was like half the tree or something like that, I would be concerned that it, you know, could do damage as it broke and fell. But there are very few trees around that don't have at least a few dead limbs in them, whether it's oaks or pecans or elms or anything else between the the things Mother Nature's thrown at us over the past 3 years. When it's convenient and you can do it safely or have someone do it for you safely, it'll look a lot nicer to take it out, but it's not going to affect the health of the remaining portion of the tree, whether you cut it or not. And the carpenter ants, they're just in dead wood. Anytime you have any dead wood in a tree, the carpenter ants are probably going to be there. And they're not really a significant issue. If you want to get rid of them, you can use a little come and get it, or you can spray a little spinosad around, but you certainly don't need to call an exterminator or anything like that.
Okay. There were just quite a few. And the bark seems to be falling off of the dead branches. And I just
that's natural. Yeah, that's natural.
Okay. Another question. I have a Rio Samba rose, and I don't know if I need spinosad or just, Dawn, a few drops of Dawn, and some water to spray. Underneath, it looks like it has maybe little tiny kind of orangey colored, maybe they almost look like little ants, but and then the leaves have kind of holes in them.
Probably aphids. I would get some spinosad soap. You can buy it as a concentrate. You can buy it in what they call ready-to-use, little hand sprayer, or you can buy what they call ready-to-spray. This in a sprayer, you just screw it onto the hose and turn the knob on it. But spinosad, I suspect you're looking at some form of aphid, and they're very, very common on roses, and they're not something that's going to kill your plant, but it's going to keep your flowers from lasting as long, and it will weaken the plant a bit. So, yeah, I just get a little spray bottle of spinosad soap and give them a good coating, and they'll be dead in a few minutes.
Okay. Well, I have some, so I'll go out there and spray it today.
As I jokingly tell people, it does no good while it's in the bottle. You have to get out there and spray it on. And the good news is it's going to be a nice day to do it. The rain that's forecast is probably at least 24 hours away, and that'll give it plenty of time to control your insects.
Great. All right. Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Have a great Sunday, Nancy, and we'll talk again. Let's see who I get to talk about now. Looks like it'll be Medina Agriculture, and what a pleasure that is. Had a nice visit. One of my employees called Stuart the other day to ask a question about, the huge load of fertilizer we're getting from him next week. And he came away and said, wow, he's a nice guy. And I said, well, he's not only a nice guy, he's one of the smartest people I've ever known. And a very humble man who's done a lot of things to make life in the world better for people all around the world. He cleaned up a chemical spill in China that they expected to impact the land for 30 years. He got it back in production in less than two. Bad contamination from mine tailings in old Russia actually found a way with his microbial technology to not only get rid of that problem, but to turn it, along with some other waste material, into a valuable fertilizer for the farmers. And that's kind of people Medina are, the kind of people that founded Medina and still operate the company. They're looking out for the good of the world, and especially right here at home, where they make products that'll work wonders in your garden, in your flower beds, in your landscape. I'm talking about things like the liquid fertilizer, has to grow plant, has to grow lawn, the new liquid fish blend, granular fertilizers like the growing green fertilizers, and then all those other things. The original product, the Medina Soil Activator, and the improved form called Medina Plus. I could spend several minutes just listing the products, let alone telling you all the good things that they do. Why don't you go to their website at medinaag.com. Check out everything that's out there for you, and visit a good nursery or garden center and see what they can do to help you have a more productive garden and a more beautiful landscape. Do it with quality products from our friends at Medina.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It looks like Ernest and Cynthia will be my next two callers, and you might be next. I think we've got an open line or two, so you know the number, 210-599-5555. I believe Ernest is next in line. Good morning, Ernest.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Bob, I've got a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
I'm in Lytle, and at the church that we attend, in the courtyard, there's a huge, massive oak tree. And okay. Numerous around the church buildings and all that. But this particular tree it's the canopy is like from the trunk, it's like 50-foot diameter all the way around.
Oh, wow. So beautiful massive. Tree, sounds like. Yes, sir.
Yes. And what's been happening over the years, there's the branches are huge, but the branch to the south of the tree, which is leaning toward the street, gradually it's been coming down. And mm-hmm. the height is, I would say, maybe 7 foot right now.
Okay.
And we were just wondering, what can we do maybe to try to help support that tree and keep it maybe in the future from falling over?
Or well, probably not going to fall over. Let me begin by saying that this is probably not a do-it-yourself project. And you're not looking at a tree trimmer. You're looking at a good arborist who knows what they're doing. It may be as simple as doing some pruning to take a little bit of weight off of that side of the tree. They also do, I'm thinking about, I eat at a wonderful restaurant here in San Antonio called La Fonda on Main, and they have actually done some cabling and bracing up in the top of their huge oak tree. And again, you need somebody that really knows what they're doing, but they will use a plastic-coated cable to help support those limbs, to help keep them a little higher. What that tree is doing is trying to keep its root system shady. It doesn't want that blazing sun on the ground, and that's why the majestic old oak trees that you know, see around, many times the canopy is practically touching the ground. That's a perfectly normal thing, but obviously it sounds like it would be in a way if things got a whole lot lower. So I would ask your parishioners there, you know, for anyone that knows a good arborist, if you want someone that I'm pretty sure would come to Lytle, you're not that far down the road, look for Vaughn, V-A-U-G-H-A-N, Vaughn Arbor Care. The man's name is David Vaughn. He doesn't have anything to sell you except a little bit of his time. He's not going to try to talk you into doing something the tree doesn't need. In fact, he might be able to help you if you just take some photographs and, you know, email him or text him to him or whatever. He might be able to, you know, to give you some good advice there. But like I say, you need somebody who really knows trees to take a look at that with you. If I can make my phone work real quickly. Are you in a position to write?
Yes, sir.
Okay. David Vaughn's phone number is area code 210-788-4986. You might give him a call, and once again, you might just be able to send him a picture or two and say, what's a quick take on it? And he's very reasonably priced. If you actually want to pay him to come down and take a look at the tree, it's not going to set you back a great deal. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, some of these hack, quack, and stack tree trimmers should just come out and butcher your tree, and that's the last thing you want. So I would get somebody that really is good. There's another guy north of San Antonio named Tyler Burkett, but David's retired from working for the best tree guy around, and he has a lot more time to get out and do consulting and things like that. So I would give him a call. But like I say, the two options that you're probably going to talk about, and you may do both, one is to carefully reduce the amount of weight out in the part of the tree that's, you know, leaning toward the building. And that may be all you need to do. Of course, with live oaks, you have to take certain precautions. But it may also be that they can do a little bit of cabling, simply tying the weaker parts of that tree into the stronger parts of the tree and make it much more less likely to ever have a problem.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information, okay?
You know, it's what I do, and it's a great pleasure to do it for you, Ernest. You get out and have a wonderful weekend, and go pray that we get some sunshine and get to watch that solar eclipse tomorrow.
Amen.
Yes, sir.
Have a great morning.
You do too, sir. Thank you so much. Cynthia, I don't want to rush you because we're down to just about a minute before the news break, so hang on just a second. You've been very patient. I'll ask you to be patient just a little bit longer, but lots of things going on out there. We are dry below the ground. Right now we've got good surface moisture. That's why we've got so many beautiful wildflowers and things. But down deep, lots of areas are pretty dry, so you may need to give some of your shrubs and things a very thorough soaking. Do not rely on a sprinkler system to do the deep watering that your landscape may need. If you've not fertilized, be sure you use an organic product so you don't create water stress, but certainly time to feed everything in your landscape, your grass, your trees, your ground covers, and still a great time. It's not so hot that we have to avoid it, but anywhere that your grass is a little thin or a little weak looking, just a thin layer of compost, quarter to half an inch over the area, and if you, like one of my earlier callers, have some bare spots in your yard, that thin top dressing of compost will do worlds to help the grass move back into those areas. Whether you have St. Augustine or Zoysia or Bermuda, compost is just a wonderful material. A little fertilizer, a little azomite, a lot of things can help a lot. We'll be right back after news. You're listening to Gardening on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to phone lines. Looks like it's going to be BB and Tony and John. BB's up first. Good morning, BB.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Hi,
Bob.
Good morning.
Hey. I've been keeping a list of questions to ask Bob, so I'm hoping we can get through with you.
All right, let's get started.
Okay, my first is about grass. My idea is to, I've got a small front yard, and I'd like to replace the turf grass with some short native grasses that I won't have to mow so much. That might, I just like that idea, and I'm wondering if you have any advice on kinds of grass to grow. It's pretty much full sun up there.
Well, look, you won't be mowing. You won't have a real full lush lawn, but you'll certainly have a water efficient lawn. Probably the least expensive way to go is there is a blend you can get from Douglas King Seed or other places they call Habiturf, H-A-B-I-T-U-R-F, and it's three different native grasses, including curly mesquite, which is one of my favorites, and oh gosh, I'd have to look up to tell you what the other two are. But what you're talking about is very definitely possible, but it's not going to look like a manicured lawn. It's not going to look like a golf green. But combine that with some native plantings, and you can have a very low maintenance and at the same time very attractive yard. The one thing about native grasses is they pretty much all require full sun or close to it. When I walk around my ranch, once I get in under the oaks and the cedar, there's almost no grass there. There's some sedges that look like grass that you could grow in shadier areas. But if you want grasses, it needs to be pretty much a really sunny area.
Okay, yeah, that's no problem, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do, so I really like that idea.
Well, call Douglas King Seed and ask him about the Habiturf blend. They'll even ship it to your doorstep if you like, or they're located over in southeast San Antonio, not too far from the fairgrounds over there, and just super nice people. Dean and all his staff, or you won't find nicer people to deal with.
Okay, and now's a good time to get that seed out?
Might be just a little early. I mean, we're still here at the 1st of March. Watch the weather. These are grasses that like to germinate and grow when it's warmer. If we stay with these days in the 70s and 80s, it'll be fine to plant. If we drop back into the 40s and 50s, it'll slow them down a little bit. But by the time you get the yard raked and ready, it'll probably be a good time to put the seed out.
Okay, great. Ooh, that's good advice. Okay, next question. I have some seeds here that I'm not sure if it's too late for me to plant or if I should wait and plant them in the fall. And it's giant coneflower seeds and helial seeds.
Coneflower, you can go ahead and plant. Coneflower is mainly a summer seeds, but it's will make a plant, and they're mainly summer and bloom into the fall, so it's not too late to plant those. What was the other one?
Heal-all?
Spell it for me if you can.
Yeah, so it's the common name, too, or it's a common name. Heal, H-E-A-L, all, A-L-L.
I'm afraid I don't know that plant. you'll need to get me, it may be a wildflower, but It's one of the ones there. That's a common name I've never heard.
Yeah, I'll have to. Okay. I'll get the botanical name for you and call back another time.
Very good.
Yeah. Another question is, can I plant a climbing rose to go up a pecan tree, or will that be bad for the tree?
Won't be bad for the tree, but you probably won't have enough sunshine for the rose. Pecan trees, you know, nice that they drop their leaves in the winter months, but they provide, if they're healthy, they provide good dense shade, and every rose out there really wants something pretty close to full sun to grow and bloom at its potential.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Do you have time for one more quick question?
Of course. Go right ahead.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you, Bob. That's about the liquid sprays, Garrett juice versus seaweed versus liquid fertilizer. I'm confused on to what to spray when.
Well, Garrett juice contains liquid seaweed, and Garrett juice would be a very low analysis fertilizer. If you want something that you can use as a spray that is more of a fertilizer product, it would be something like Medina's product that they call Hastergrow Plant. There's Hastergrow Plant and Hastergrow Lawn. Hastergrow Plant is a good general spray for just about everything. You can certainly add some more liquid seaweed to it. And, you know, the Garrett juice started out just as an idea, and it's not one formula. You can buy it pre-mixed according to, you know, the original, but there's nothing at all wrong with adding some molasses, adding some seaweed, adding some liquid fish. If you just want it all together without having to mix all those different things up, you pretty much get it. And nothing wrong with, like, spraying with Garrett juice one time and then spraying with the Medina Hastergrow the next time. That'd be a great plan for most plants.
Okay, yeah, because I saw it in the feed store, the Garrett juice, Medina premix, and I thought, oh, they also had the Hastergrow liquid fertilizer, and I was just wondering, well, I'm just not sure when I would use one over the other.
Well, just use as is convenient for you. It's kind of like saying, you know, there's hamburger, there's steak, there's chicken, there's fish. What am I going to have? Well, vary it. Have one time and one the next time, and your plants will love the variety.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much, Bob.
Most gardening does make sense when you think about it, BB. So you just call me anytime you have questions. Love to talk to you.
Absolutely will. You have a great day.
Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right, Tony and John, hang on just a second here. It looks like I get to talk. All right. I tell you what, we had some technical problems there. Mike, hold on. I'll be coming back to you in just a minute. But great engineer at the station, and we got our problems cleared up. So we'll just move forward with the show as usual. I do want to go back and talk about Dr. Williamson for a second, and then we'll talk to Mike and move right on down the list. But I've known Dr. Mark Williamson for many years, knew him back when he first joined Dr. Staffel's practice, and talk about two great minds making something even better. Well, we lost Dr. Staffel a few years back, but Dr. Williamson is still out there solving people's dental needs, and he's the most broadly trained dentist I think I've ever known. So many dentists these days, if it's more than just a cleaning or filling, they want to spend you out to a specialist. Well, Dr. Williamson is that specialist. I can't think of any oral health issue that he can't solve right there in his office. He offers, sedation dentistry, different techniques that will allow him to accomplish more in a single visit and make you more comfortable in the chair if you desire. If you're looking for a new dentist, if you're new to the area and want to start with the best, I'd highly suggest you talk to Dr. Mark Williamson. The office is conveniently located out of Northwest San Antonio, out on Cherry Ridge Drive out there. I think they call that Conroy Square, but real easy to find and just a great, great experience. When you go in and meet the office staff, when you meet Dr. Williamson, you will know you're at the right place. If you want to learn more, just give him a call, 341-2569. That's 341-2569, area code 210, for Dr. Williamson and Associates.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. I think we've got our technical problems behind us, so we'll just move forward with the show. looks like we'll go back to Mike at this point. Mike, sorry about the interruption. Glad you hung on.
Not a problem. Hey, I got a question on my St. Augustine lawns in the process put out a couple of weeks ago some cornmeal for some brown patch.
Uh-huh.
And this past week I sprayed some beneficial nematodes. And so I'm due to come back and put out the cornmeal. Will that be bad for the nematodes?
No. No, nematodes, they're over, 600,000 different species of them. They're tough little critters, and there is no interaction whatsoever between the beneficial nematode. Actually, what you're doing is putting out several different species of beneficial nematodes that target grub worms, fire ants, fleas, all sorts of different things, but no interaction at all. Go ahead and do it in either order. You can cornmeal first, nematodes later, nematodes, and then fertilizer, then cornmeal, but the three of them work independently of each other.
Good. And then is that for, like, damaged places, spots in the yard, like every 2-4 week type deal, and as you go through the summer, or what is your thought on that?
I certainly wouldn't think you're going to have to do nearly that much. Realize that if the damage was caused by grub worms, they are long gone, and they don't, in effect, leave anything behind in the soil. Your grub worm's going to turn into a June bug. June bugs are going to fly around and lay more eggs. That creates little bitty grubs called the first and second larval instars that do all the damage to your yard. So if you want to do one application of beneficial nematodes, it's going to carry you for the next 3 or 4 months. Beyond that, a little bit of compost, a little bit of fertilizer, appropriate watering, and a little bit of time is what it's going to take to bring things back. But really, once you've done the fertilizer and the compost and the nematodes, sit back and just, water as needed and let your grass take over again.
And so the same thing would be true with the brown patch?
Yeah. Once you've treated with your cornmeal one time, brown patch fungus, Rhizoctonia it's called, tends to show up when we have warm days and cool nights. Sadly, we're about to get beyond the cool nights, I'm afraid, and so it's unlikely that you're going to have any additional brown patch show up.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Have a great week.
Well, you do the same, sir. I appreciate the call. Thank you. Let's go ahead and talk to Ken. Good morning, Ken.
Hi there. Question
good morning.
Good morning. The question we have is dollarweed. We have an infestation of it in mm-hmm. our flower beds, in our lawn. Never really had it bad before. How do you get rid of it?
Stop watering so much. The so-called dollarweed is a plant which likes a lot of moisture. All of our lawn grasses, be it Bermuda, Zoysia, or St. Augustine, do not need to be watered more than once a week. You want to water very thoroughly when you water, and the dollarweed, just simply will die out. Now, you want to water thoroughly when you water, but be sure you're going this time of year, probably even 10 days between waterings, and when you cut back on the frequency of watering, the dollarweed will die out.
Okay, and it's coming back in the flower beds where we've got drip irrigation, but
uh-huh.
Are we overwatering the plants then also?
You're watering too often. There's no such thing really as overwatering, because if a little bit of water is good, a whole lot of water is better. But it's very important that you let the soil dry to the proper point before you water again. And I think you're probably just watering a little too frequently with your drip irrigation. This time of year, again, we're not into the, super hot summer temperatures when we have to water more frequently. But unless something is very newly planted, I can't think of anything in a flower bed that would need water more than every week or 10 days. And if you're doing some, planting in some new petunias or dianthus or getting up on periwinkle season, just plan on hand watering a little bit on those to get them off to a good start. But I wouldn't be running that drip system more than every week or 10 days, and I think you'll find that your dollarweed will gradually go away. If you want to get in with a grubbing hoe or something like that and, shall we say, hasten its demise, you can certainly do that. But dollarweed is a moisture-loving plant that you just come back on the moisture and it'll be gone.
All right. Thank you.
Well, you're sure welcome. Thank you for the call. Let's see here. Greg, I guess we better get another break in here, and then we'll move forward. Looks like I get to talk to you about a new company and a new product. Really great, veteran. It's just a neat member of our military that happens to live up in the Bernie area and started this company called Aqualock. Aqualock makes a lot of different products. You can go to their website at aqualock.com and see the complete line. But the two that I really want to focus on, the two that I think are going to do the greatest good for your plants in this area, one of them is called Supercast. The other is called Terralock. What the Terralock is a natural product. It's made from a number of different things, believe it or not, even including banana peels and things like that. But it forms a product in the soil that helps attract and hold water in the soil. Now, it breaks down naturally over about a year and a half, but in the meantime, it'll make your watering go further. It'll help your soil stay moist longer without worrying about the depleting of the oxygen in the soil. It has to be blended into the soil. It's not something you just sprinkle on. It's something that you mix in with the soil, which makes it perfect for pots or hanging baskets. You can actually blend it into the soil if you're planting a new flower bed or something like that, but it will really decrease the frequency of watering and helps maintain the moisture and nutrients in the soil. Their other product that I like so well in this area is called Supercast, and it's a product based on some really premium worm castings with some other biostimulants added, and then a small amount of the Terralock type product, once again to help hold the moisture in the soil. At the same time, you're realizing all the benefits of the many microbes and the nutrients that come in with the worm castings. Supercast, Terralock, both of them are available at fine nurseries and garden centers throughout the area. Just remember, you blend them into the soil. You don't just sprinkle them on the surface. They'll pay for themselves in water savings this summer. I can virtually guarantee it. Products from Aqualock called Supercast and Terralock.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Sunday morning. It's going to be Ezell, Scott, Gina, and Diane. Ezell is up first. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
I do have a couple of questions today. I've been using diatomaceous earth to kill bugs and things around the house. But
yes, sir.
I was wondering the other day, can that be used for bugs on flowers and like roses and things like that instead of using spinosad, because I have a lot of diatomaceous earth and I would like to make use of it if I could.
Okay. Well, that's a really good question. And diatomaceous earth is what we would call an abrasive. The way it kills is by getting down into the joints of insects. Insects don't have an internal skeleton like you and I do. They rely on their harder shell basically to support their bodies. And diatomaceous earth gets down in the joints, starts cutting, and the insect dehydrates and dies. So DE is not going to work on something that's soft like a caterpillar or maybe an aphid, but if you're dealing with a hard-shelled insect, like a beetle of any sort, or a grasshopper, or an ant, diatomaceous earth will work very well. It'll do absolutely nothing toward slugs and snails. We'll do some good against pill bugs. But anything that has a harder shell to it, that's where your DE is going to do a good job. It'll get roaches. It'll get fleas. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I kind of understood that, but I just didn't know if I could use it for other type of insects around.
Oh, absolutely. And you can actually, it's been a long time since I've seen them, but they make little dusters, little puffers. They used to make something called the Dustin Miser. The challenge is figuring out, you know, how to get the DE on the insects. And I guess you can just, you know, almost use almost anything that would just kind of blow it out over them. But no, it'll work great against ants and other things that have a hard shell.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. That's one down. One more.
Okay.
I have some palmetto grass that took a real beating last year.
Right.
And I have a lot of bare spots and all that. And I see little sprigs coming up, so I put some compost, manure compost over the grass.
Perfect.
Hoping it would help it. Hoping it would help it. Those little sprigs that are coming up. But is there any seed that you would recommend that I could try and fill in for now that would grow pretty quick till that St. Augustine would take over?
Well, your St. Augustine is just about to kick into high gear. So seeds, I mean, we're right at the end of the season for cool weather seeds. If we were having this discussion in December or January, yeah, I would be recommending a good winter rye or something like that. But at this point, you've already put your compost out. I would make an application of a good fertilizer. And that's basically all you need to do. Your St. Augustine's going to start growing as the days and nights get warmer, and it's going to outgrow anything else that you could plant. I mean, I guess there wouldn't be any harm in putting a little more winter rye out. It's going to last until the summer gets really hot. But if you had a mush issue or something like that, I'd just look for, you know, a good, what they call perennial ryegrass. It's not really going to be perennial, but that's something you could throw out that would sprout in about 3 or 4 days and give you some green. But I think you're going to be really amazed at how quickly your St. Augustine's going to begin growing as we get into warmer weather. So the choice is pretty much yours. I would fertilize no matter what you do, but beyond that, if you want to throw out a little rye seed, go right ahead. If you want to, you know, leave town and go to Switzerland for a month, your yard will be beautiful when you get back.
Okay, well, that sounds good then.
Or New Zealand.
Well, thank you once again, Bob.
Well, you're more than I appreciate the call. Good questions. Moving along, our next caller will be Scott. Good morning, Scott.
Morning, Bob.
Morning, sir.
Okay, I got a Phalaenopsis orchid question for you.
All right.
I don't know if it's the bloom spike that's coming up or three more roots are coming up, but they're about halfway up the plant stalk right now.
Okay.
And they're much thicker than the other ones that came out. Is now an okay time to fertilize it, or should I wait until after it decides if it's a bloom stalk or a...
There's never a bad time to fertilize an orchid. By all means, you know, liquid fertilizers work best. I alternate the Has to Grow plant with the liquid fish blend. And remember that in nature, your Phalaenopsis would be clinging to the side of a tree or the side of a house or a telephone pole or something like that. And those roots, they take up moisture, they take up nutrients, they dry out, and they're ready for the next dose. So absolutely fertilize at your earliest convenience. Now, how long have you had this orchid, and is it still in bloom?
No, it's not in bloom. I've had it for 2 years, and I finally moved it to my bathroom in the window. So it seems to be liking that a little bit better since it gets, you know, constant moisture from the shower.
Have it actually gets
decent light.
Have you repotted it?
Yes, I repotted it, 2 years ago.
Okay. Well, you're in great shape. Yeah, you're in great shape. You've gotten it out of that sphagnum. You've gotten it into a much better medium for it. Many orchid growers, and I started growing orchids in the eighth grade, and I'm not going to tell you how long ago that was, but many orchid growers, you know, fertilize every time they water with a dilute solution. They say I like to feed weekly, but and others feed whenever they get around to it, make their fertilizer a little stronger, and maybe feed once a month. The plants don't really seem to care. And you'll be able to tell fairly quickly, and you already know this if you've had it for a couple of years, but the new roots will come out with that bright green, looks like a hard jelly-like tip on them, whereas the bloom spikes will come out just as a solid green and fairly quickly will turn upward. So, you know, another week or so you're going to know which it is, but that should have no impact at all on your fertilizing, whether you're, you know, doing it as a, you know, foliar feeding or applying it to the medium. It wouldn't make any difference at all whether it's a root or a new bloom spike.
Okay. So once we start seeing the white on that, it's probably not a bloom spike?
It's probably not. And recognize that the day will come, probably not for a year or two, but that Phalaenopsis may actually kind of divide up toward the top and start actually producing a second set of leaves and grow up almost as a double plant. I've seen that happen. Phalaenopsis are closely related to something called a Dorytus. Then they've been hybrid before, make a hybrid they call a Dorytonopsis. And there are probably upwards of 50,000 different hybrids based on Phalaenopsis now. So it's hard to generalize, but their growth habit is pretty much the same. Some of them, you know, will form new little plantlets on the bloom spike. One of the reasons we don't ever cut the bloom spikes off until they start to shrivel. But the culture is the same regardless on all of them. Just don't ever let them get bone dry. Feed as frequently as you like. And sounds like you know what you're doing. Just don't worry about whether it's a spike or a root. Either one will be good for the plant.
No, I don't really know what I'm doing. That's the problem. I just now got it to where I was like, okay, I'm actually going to take care of this. So,
well, but, I have a good friend, or had a good friend. He's passed away a couple of years ago, but he used to define an expert as a person who's killed at least 1,000 plants, and I qualify, but it's my job to help you keep from becoming an expert. But most people overdo it with orchids. Orchids are tough little plants. Probably the main thing to remember with Phalaenopsis is they do not tolerate cold. Below 60 degrees, they will languish. So you want to keep them warm. You want to keep them bright. You don't ever want to let them dry out because they don't have any water storage organ like the cattleyas or dendrobiums or other orchids do. But biggest thing you have to worry about with Phalaenopsis is getting hooked on them, and then you just don't know where to stop. And you know, first thing you'll know, you'll have your whole bathroom window filled, and then you'll be wanting to put in a light stand to grow some more, and then you'll be building a greenhouse somewhere. It's this little addiction that gets lots of us when you become successful with them, but it's not a bad thing.
Well, and not to mention certain people that are probably listening right now, if they'd stop giving them to my mother, my collection would probably stop growing, too.
Well, I tell you what, there are a whole lot worse things to be addicted to, and you certainly make a lot of friends, you know, when you have orchids to share and all. So I'm not going to feel any sympathy for you whatsoever. I got bitten a lot of years ago, and I still haven't found any cure for it.
One more question. What?
Yeah.
As a helicopter flies right over. By how much can you trim back citrus?
Like all plants, it's not how much you can trim back, it's how much of the foliage you can take away at any one time. Don't ever prune them so heavily that you've taken away more than about a third of the foliage on the plant. And that could be a lot or it could be a little, but it's much better to make several lighter prunings than to make such a severe pruning that you remove too much of the foliage. They need that constant inflow of new material that can only be produced in green tissue. So prune as much as you like. I like pruning while the plants are in bloom. That way I can leave the limbs that are going to have the largest amount of fruit and take out the ones that will have less fruit. But just base your pruning on the percentage of foliage that you would remove and try not to exceed
30%. 30%, okay. Well, I messed up on that one then, but I think it'll be okay.
Very good.
Yeah, I had a Persian, what do you call those? Lime,
Persian lime, yeah.
It was getting very hard to wheel in and out, so I may have gone 50%.
Well, you didn't cause any permanent damage. You'll slow it down a little bit, but it'll be just fine.
All right. Well, that was it. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Scott. Gene and Diane, hold on. We'll visit with you in just a moment. Right now, I get to talk about Phanix Nursery and Garden Center, celebrating 85 years in business. They're planning a big celebration in June, which is their actual anniversary. But right now, they're offering specials. They're offering more seminars. They had a grafting seminar yesterday, and the Rose Society was out answering questions for people about roses. But just there's always something fun going on over at Phanix. You can always check their website at Phanix, F-A-N-I-C-K, phanixnursery.com, to see what's happening. Right now, they did want me to remind you that they've got all kinds of trees, shade trees, this green tree shade rebate program where CPS Energy will give you up to $50 credit for each tree that you plant. That ends at the end of April. So if you think you need to plant some more shade trees, get over to Fanix and pick up on the qualifying trees and get them in while you can still get that big credit. I mean, $50, that's practically going to pay for a 5-gallon tree for you, and it's just a program you really don't want to miss out on. Fanix is well stocked on all sorts of warm weather veggies. They've got a great selection of roses, great selection of citrus, along with the shade trees. I could go on and on. All the different natural products, organic products that you're looking for, plenty of flowering bedding plants for the warm season, and all those eco lithium-ion battery-powered pieces of outdoor equipment, including, I understand they've got a riding mower now. I've got to get over and see that. And, of course, they carry the Traeger pellet grills and all the supplies that you need. Fanix is so much more than just a nursery. They're right where they've been for 85 years over on Home Green Street in Southeast San Antonio. And like I say, you can visit their website at fanixnursery.com to see what's going on today and every day at Fanix Nursery and Garden Center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening and back to the phone calls. Gina is next in line. Good morning, Gina.
Hey, good morning. Happy Sunday.
And to you as well.
Hi, I'm calling from the north side of San Antonio here, where I have an extremely shaded yard.
Okay.
But there is one side where I do have along a fence where it does get full sun.
All right.
I am contemplating in between the Confederate star jasmine for a vine, the Confederate star jasmine, and then yesterday at the garden store, I also saw a crossvine tangerine, and then
Tangerine Beauty,
Madison,
right?
Mm-hmm. Tangerine Beauty and a Madison Hardy star jasmine.
Uh huh.
And so I'm just looking for something that will be able to definitely tolerate all the crazy weather that we've had and that we'll continue to have.
Yep. The Tangerine Beauty Crossvine is by far the most cold hardy. And of course, there's several different forms of star jasmine or Confederate jasmine, two names for the same plant. But that is one plant that did suffer damage back in 21 and actually had some damage this January when they had the cold spell. We've got a lot of it planted here at Shades of Green, and it all has come back beautifully. But if you want something that will tolerate the sun and will tolerate the occasional really cold spell, Tangerine Beauty Crossvine is probably going to be the hardiest choice. Now, it doesn't have nearly the fragrance that your Confederate jasmine does, but it grows vigorously, blooms heavily in the spring, and then scatters some flowers through the rest of the year. If you ever go down to the Pearl, that's what you see growing everywhere down there. They've got, must be hundreds or even thousands of plants of the crossvine. And like I say, its greatest claim is that it is a little bit more cold hardy. On the other hand, we went for close to 30 years without having a cold enough winter to really hurt the star jasmine or Confederate jasmine, whichever name you prefer. The variety you're talking about is one that has more of a cream-colored flower, whereas your basic star jasmine is much more white. But both of them bloom profusely this time of year. Both of them have a very strong fragrance. And other than the little susceptibility to cold, very little bothers them. They grow very quickly. You could plant a 1-gallon container at the bottom of that fence, and by midsummer, it'll be 2 feet above the top of the fence.
Mm. Okay.
So,
and then
Confederate jasmine, it will tolerate a little bit of shade as well, but it just won't bloom as well in the shade. So your sunny area would be better for all of these vines.
Okay. And then is it too late to compost the yard, or should we just use the Medina spray?
I would maybe go with some fertilizer and then put your compost down. For at least the next couple of weeks, it looks like the weather's still going to be perfect for applying the compost.
All right. Appreciate your help. Thank you so much.
You get out and have a great Sunday, Gina. I appreciate the call. Thank you. And only got about 30 seconds here until news time, Diane, so hold on just a second. You will be up first when we come back. Once again, time to get things planted out there. In the vegetable garden, I think you're still a little early on okra. Let that soil warm up a little bit more. But a great time to plant peppers and tomatoes and eggplant and squash and cucumbers and bush beans and black-eyed peas. I can think of lots and lots of work for you to do out in the vegetable garden. We'll talk some about flowers a little later, too. This is KTSA Radio.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, there's one line open. You dial that number, you can grab it. We're going to talk to Diane and Warren and Sylvia. Diane's first in line. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Bob. How are you doing today?
Oh, now that we've got our little technical glitches behind us, life is good. What can I say? How about you?
I'm doing okay. Just at the gym waiting for my turn, so multitasking.
Very good.
Okay, so what causes chlorosis?
Well, chlorosis is basically defined as a condition where the veins of the leaves remain darker green, the tissue around them becomes lighter in color. Chlorosis is caused by a deficiency of any one of several different things or a combination of things. We refer to it as iron chlorosis when it's, you know, due to a lack of iron. And, of course, iron is central to many different things, including the chlorophyll molecule. If it's a deficiency in nitrogen, you know, we could call it nitrogen chlorosis or magnesium. There's several different things, but it is a deficiency in one or another mineral or compound that leads to this this yellowing, this overall yellowing of the tissue, and in most cases the veins remain green. Is that specific enough?
That is. So my bush morning glory, the one that I take cuttings off of to make new beautiful plants for a local nursery, is so chlorotic, and I feed it with liquid fertilizer, like the fish one or the other one that Medina makes, the liquid. And then, so it got this chlorotic, it's so bad. And I've been putting the azomite, and so I have it in a container, which is probably way too small for the plant now,
okay,
which might be part of the problem. But I put azomite on top mm-hmm. of the soil, like once in a month and then the next month. And it is
sure.
Nothing is making it better.
A little bit of warm weather is going to help. The bush morning glories are truly hot weather plants. And when they are not carrying on, you know, a high rate of metabolism, even a good source like azomite is not going to make a whole lot of difference. You let it warm up a little bit, say you get our average temperature up by 10 or 15 degrees, I think you will find that things green up in a hurry. If it were mine, I would think about moving it to a little bit bigger container and just blending some azomite into the soil, you know, that you're potting into. And that, I think, is going to give you the best results. But I don't think you're going to see a lot of change until we get a little bit warmer nights, a little bit overall warmer soil temperatures. I think what you're looking at is a condition aggravated, you know, by the weather that we absolutely love right now, but a plant that would really prefer to have it 100 degrees.
Okay, so then let me ask you this. If I take cuttings from it now, and I start them in 4-inch pots and move up to the size y'all like to see them in.
Yeah.
And I put those cuttings, you know, once they're rooted in a real good mix, will they green up?
Absolutely.
Or will they all wait till it's
no,
warm.
No, they as it warms up, they will green up. And okay. Once again, here I would be blending some azomite and maybe some granular fertilizer as well into your soil mix that you're going to be using, because it's that way you're getting the things the plants need in much closer proximity to the root zone than if you were to wait until they were already potted up and then add something to the surface. This is a great opportunity to enrich the medium that you're growing them in.
Yeah, that's exactly what I do. I get plain old boring potting soil, and then I add my own recipe to it to make everything spectacular.
Do you have a propagating mat?
Somewhere.
Well, it's not doing any good in the garage or the garden shed or whatever else. You put, number one, you'll get your cuttings rooted much more quickly if you put your tray of rooting medium on a propagating mat. And after you have potted these things up, you will greatly enhance the root growth, which will greatly enhance the overall growth of the plants. So I think I would do a little propagating mat search, and I think this will make a great deal of difference in how things look.
Okay, Bob. Awesome. Thank you so much.
You are certainly welcome, and Axel says hello.
Hi, Axel. I'll talk to you later.
I'll talk to you then, Diane. Thank you so much. Goodbye. All right, Warren is next in line. Good morning, Warren.
Hello, Bob. How are you doing today?
Off to a good start. It's going to be a wonderful day. Great time of year.
Right. Bob, I live in Lytle.
Uh-huh.
On the Medina water system.
Right.
How does that affect the liquid fertilizers and nematodes and stuff like that if I use the water to mix with them?
It's not really going to have any negative consequences. The water is going to be alkaline because all the water in this area is somewhat alkaline. It would be really nice if you had a nice big rainwater catchment system and you could do your watering with rainwater, but that good old Medina, you know, I'm sure they're using a combination of groundwater and surface water. And as long as they are not overdoing it with treatment, most of your better water companies purify their water with ultraviolet light now instead of going with the chlorine that we use for so many years. But smell your water. If you're not smelling chlorine in it, it'll be just fine for your plants.
Yeah. Okay. That's the main thing I had, because I use it for, like, you know, the nematodes and everything, and I didn't know if it might be affecting them and all that. But
no, it's really not. Again, some older water system companies still use either chlorine or this even worse product called chloramine, which doesn't get out as of the water as quickly. Chlorine pretty much turns to a gas and goes away after a few hours. Chloramine works longer. If you feel like, you know, that your water, I tell you, just take a glass of water and just smell it. Or when you get in the shower in the morning, smell that water. If you get a chlorine smell to it and you want to do the very best thing you could do for your plants, you go to an aquarium shop. They have little drops, little bottles of drops that they put in the water when you're going to put your tropical fish in the water, and it neutralizes the chlorine or chloramine that's in there. And if you were growing real sensitive plants, if you were growing Venus flytraps or some of the carnivorous plants or things like that, it probably would be a good idea to get some. And you get it at any pet store, any aquarium shop. But in general, a public water system company like that is going to have water that's fine for your plants, unless you're growing really sensitive plants. But just do the old sniff test, and if you start getting a real chlorine smell, then try to improve the water a little bit before you put it on any of the plants that are likely to be sensitive.
Okay. Well, that sounds good. That's what I wanted to know.
And if the other thing that you could do, again, a water softener is not going to take it out, but an RO system, a reverse osmosis system, If they are adding anything unpleasant to the water, an RO system will take it out. They're not terribly expensive. In some cases, it's not a perfect situation because you need a lot of the minerals that are in the water, but you don't need a lot of the crud that sometimes gets put in there. But just ask about an RO drinking water system, and like I say, that will take out any possible contaminant that could be in there. You may have to add a little bit more fertilizer to the water to get the results you're looking for, but it's like if you go down in the Rio Grande Valley, the growers down there producing plants commercially, there is so much sodium in the water that's down there that they use reverse osmosis to change the water to something that will grow better plants without the burning. And I doubt that you need to go with that, but you can just kind of judge by the quality of the water. The other thing that you can do is you can ask your water system, tell them that you would like to see, you know, a test of their water, because periodically, you know, they test, and it should be the water system, but it could also be the groundwater district. We run a pretty thorough chemical test on our water every few months up in Kendall County, where I serve on the water board, and they can probably send you a report that's going to tell you exactly what is in your water and should cost you a penny. And if you want to, you can do that and then call, and we'll talk about the different amounts of things that are in there and if any of them would have a negative effect on your plants. In general, won't be, but you sound like you're an interested and interesting person, and if you'd like to learn a little bit more, just call your water system, because they are required to do these water tests periodically, and they should be willing and able to give you a copy of that when you ask for it.
Okay, that sounds good, Bob.
Very good.
The answer.
Yep, well, you're more than welcome, Warren. Good question, and I appreciate the call. Sylvia, hang on. We need to get a break in here. You will be up next. Greg, I don't have any more lives, so run those recordings, and we'll get back to talking to folks.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening on a nice Sunday morning out there. So we're going to visit with Sylvia, Omar, Chris, and Roger. Sylvia's first in line. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a couple of questions. Okay. One of them is I put some potato plants, red potatoes, in some potato bags and a pot,
uh-huh,
just to see if I could do it right.
And so, you could do it, couldn't you?
Yeah, they're growing, but I'm just concerned, like, do I need to put any kind of, besides fertilizer, like look out for any kind of bugs or anything like that?
They get a few of nuisance insects like aphids we see periodically, but they're not really susceptible to any major problems. If you're just watering and fertilizing, just keep an eye on them. If you see little fat-bodied, usually kind of yellow-colored insects on the back of the leaves, might need to spray a little spinosad or something, but potatoes are pretty trouble-free.
Okay. So then my second question is, I have a rose bush, and it has some really pretty flowers on it. My sister gave it to me last year.
Good.
She bought it from one of those people on TV. And I put it in a pot, and it has some really pretty flowers. But the same thing, I know rose glow is the one that you talk about. And is that just a general, like, insecticide?
It's a fertilizer. Yeah, rose glow.
It's a fertilizer. Okay.
Yeah. Roses are susceptible to, you know, a number of different things. If you're fertilizing regularly, if you're keeping them out in full sun, you're not going to have very many problems. But if we get into real rainy weather, they're subject to some fungus diseases like black spot and powdery mildew. As we get into hotter, drier weather, you can have issues with spider mites. You could have issues with aphids. You do your best to maintain your fertilizing and watering, and you will have very few problems. If you do have insect problems, the spinosad soap is probably what you'll use to correct them. If you have fungal issues, you probably You could spray with neem oil or something, but in general, probably just soak a little cornmeal in water and use that to spray with. But as long as you've got good sunlight, good air circulation, and as long as you're fertilizing and watering, you're not going to have many problems. It's not that difficult to grow roses well. The people that have trouble are the people that try to grow them in the shade, the people that aren't regular in their watering, the people that just, you know, let them get too dry or keep them too wet. I think you're probably a pretty good gardener, and I think you'll be very successful with your roses.
I don't know if I'm a pretty good gardener. I'm a gardener.
Well, we're all learning on a daily basis, and as you've probably heard me tell other people, when you buy roses, if you can, I love buying what they call own root roses, roses that are not grafted, but roses that are actually growing on their own roots. But many of the newest and fanciest roses are always going to be grafted because they can produce so many more roses from a given plant. And on those, the most important thing is get them grafted on the right rootstock. A lot of the box stores sell roses from Lyndale and Tyler in East Texas, and they use a rootstock called Dr. Schragen that does not do well in San Antonio. But your bigger California companies, and that would be Jackson Perkins, Weeks, Armstrong, virtually all of those companies use a rootstock which does just fine in San Antonio. So be a little careful where you acquire your roses. And if you buy them from a good nursery like Fanix or somewhere like that, you're not going to have to worry about it. But you do your part, start with good plants, and you'll have very few problems to worry about.
And this was a bare root. It wasn't in any kind of medium when we got it.
Yeah.
So I just put it in some potting soil.
That's fine.
Last question I have is, I have a little space in the front of my house. It's like 3 feet wide and about 12 feet long. And I have mulch in there now. But I want to put rocks in there. So do I have to take the mulch out? Can I just throw the rocks on top?
Just throw the rocks on top.
Okay.
What do you have anything growing in that flower bed?
No, everything I have is in pots.
Okay. So you'd like to put some rocks on and set your pots in there? No, absolutely no reason to take the mulch out. Just put your big pots on top of it. Do not put any weed block or any kind of fabric underneath because that'll cause more problems. But no, just put your rocks on top of your mulch, put your pots on top of the rocks, and you're good to go.
And the rocks, if I get white rocks and the mulch is black, is that going to dye the rocks black or not?
That's a hard question to answer. If it is a natural dark-colored mulch, there will be some things in there that may stain, but they're not really going to dye. If it is a mulch which has been dyed, and there is a dyed black mulch and a dyed red mulch out there, I don't like either one of them because the dyes are toxic. So wherever you get your mulch, just ask. If you're buying it in bags, just read the bag. And if it says it's dyed, then avoid that one. Just get a natural mulch. Most mulches will turn a dark color, will approach black color, you know, as they age. So just try to stay away from a dyed mulch, and it should not impact your white rocks at all.
Okay. I don't know what color I'm going to get yet, but I was just thinking ahead. If I get white, is that going to be a problem?
Well, you're always going to get some staining, and but no, you should get what you like, and you know, you can always, if they get a little stained, you can always add a little bit of fresh rock to the top of the bed, and they'll be back to beautiful.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Celia. And I believe next in line is going to be Omar, then Chris and Roger. Good morning, Omar.
Good morning, Bob. How you doing?
Off to a good start. It's a beautiful day out there. How about you?
It is. It is. Oh, just same old, same old. My Meyer's lemon started off with a bunch of lemons, and everything was rocking along. And within the last 45 days or so, I've done azomite, granular, Astro Grow, and liquid Astro Grow. Well, it shed all of those lemons, and now it flowered up again and started. Now I've got a bunch of little lemons, you know, starting again. Mm-hmm. Just wondering what happened the first time. Is that just a cycle or what? Is that normal?
You know, it's hard to say. A citrus tree can many times start producing the little lemon before the flower even gets pollinated. And when the little lemon starts to grow, gets up maybe to the size of an English pea, and then falls off, many times that's a sign that it didn't get well pollinated. You didn't have the bees out there to do it. So while you've got those open flowers, I get your little paintbrush and just start dusting around from flower to flower, and make, you know, making certain that you, the plant has a way of sensing. The purpose of making a lemon is not to make Omar happy. It's to make a seed in there to reproduce itself. And the plant can tell whether or not it got pollinated, and not to give them conscious thought, but in its own chemical way, the plant's saying, hey, this is not, this fruit's not going to make any seeds, so I might as well get rid of it. And then it falls off. And that's the most common reason that the little tiny lemons start to develop but then fall off. It can also be a matter of getting too dry, but once again, it's not usually 100%. Rarely would it ever be a lack of nutrient, and once again, you would expect it to only affect a certain percentage, where basically you've had just everything started to form and then dropped off. My guess is poor pollination, and bees are in trouble. I mean, when I look around, you know, the garden, we just not seeing the honeybees that we usually see. Everything we can do to attract the native mason bees and things like that, that's going to be good for things in the long term. But why chance it? While it's got blooms on it, just get out there with your paintbrush and do the bees' job for them, and I think you'll have a lot more lemons for them.
Gotcha. Well, the flowers are gone. They're all little bitty lemons right now, and there is a bunch of them.
Well,
but, I'll keep an eye out and see if it does it again. I'll make sure and do my part.
And don't be surprised if you have a few of them drop off, because that's not necessarily bad. If a tree can produce a certain number of pounds, let's say your lemon tree could make, you know, 20 pounds of lemons, you can either have 20 lemons that weigh a pound apiece or 200 lemons that weigh a couple of ounces each. So sometimes it's a good thing to have fewer limbs and a little bit lemons and a little bit better quality. But one thing you can do that will certainly help keep the maximum number of lemons on the plant is do a little foliar feeding as well. Whatever you're feeding with the Has to Grow or the air juice or whatever liquid, spray the leaves as well as giving the soil a good drench with it, and I think you'll find this will help the plant develop a larger number of lemons.
Gotcha. All righty, sir. I appreciate it.
I appreciate your call. Get out and have a wonderful Sunday, and we'll talk again. Greg, let's get a break in here. Chris and Roger will be my next two callers right after this short commercial break.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. It's going to be Chris and Roger and Cindy and Tony. Chris is first in line. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call, Bob.
Thanks for calling.
I have a question.
Okay.
A couple weeks ago, I had a whole bunch of June bugs that showed up. And so I went to your place and I got the two of those little things for the nematodes.
Yeah, little sponges.
The sponges. So since we're having rain, supposedly Monday and Tuesday, I went ahead and watered my grass really good Friday and then Saturday. And then Saturday night, I put them in. My question is, how do I know they're going to work?
Well, if you had wanted to, you could have put one of those sponges in a glass of water or something and taken a magnifying glass. You can actually see the little nematodes are like microscopic worms. And the company that we use, you get actually several different species of the nematodes. And they target grubworm or June bug larvae, which we call grub worms. They target fire ants. They target fleas. And if you've got two sponges, you've got 2 million nematodes. And assuming that, you know, put them out either with a bucket or with a good sprayer, you put them in soil that was moist, which is absolutely right because they don't crawl, they swim. And you should not have any issue with the eggs laid by that flight of June bugs. Now, the individual June bug, or the individual nematode, rather, lives about 90 days. As long as they are finding things like fire ants or grubs to reproduce in, those numbers stay up. if after 90 days or so you see another major flight of June bugs, you might want to reapply, but you should be able to rest easy for the next 90 days knowing that you're pretty much totally protected from grub worms.
Okay. Yeah, because that's my thing, because the grub worms really got my yard last year, and I didn't see that after effect until, you know, the springtime when I really said, oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's the problem, because the grubs cut the roots, but the grass doesn't show the effect until later, and by the time you realize what the problem was, the damage has already been done. But you did exactly the right thing. Takes his eggs for the grub worms about 10 days to 2 weeks to hatch. So if you waited 2 weeks after you saw the June bugs, put out your nematodes, you did it exactly right. You should be in good shape.
Okay. Yeah, because that's what I did. I said, I think about almost 3 weeks I waited. But then then the rain was coming, so I thought, well, let me go ahead and do it. The other question I have is it okay to fertilize the yard?
Absolutely.
Have rain coming in.
Yeah, absolutely. Organic fertilizers do not burn. You know, the synthetic chemical stuff, you better get water on them right after you put it out, and then, you know, 80% of the fertilizer washes away. The benefit of using the organic products is that they are bound in the soil through a process we call cation exchange capacity. They don't have to be watered in, but, you know, the water really activates the microbes, which in turn release the nutrients. So, again, nice thing about organic fertilizers, you can put them on wet or dry, hot or cold, and the rains are, you know, going to be of good benefit. I think you pretty much you're in line for a very good spring. You've done everything right.
All righty. Yeah, I was like, well, I'm going to try this again. But, yeah, I didn't put them in a glass of water. I just put the sponge in the container, and I shook it, wringed it out, then I put it into a pump sprayer.
Well, you're doing it right. But if you ever want to see these little guys and you have a good magnifying glass, actually, if you look at that little sponge, you'll see kind of a little drop of goo in the middle. If you were to take a toothpick or something and just get a little bit of that on the end of the toothpick and then, you know, swirl it around in a small tumbler of water, they are visible if you have really good eyes. If you have kids or somebody with a science fair project that have even a simple microscope, you can see them. They look like they're generally, they look like a miniature clear worm. They're not segmented. They're smooth. They don't have segments like an earthworm does. They just have a clear, it's called a cuticle, that coats the body, and this is what allows them to, well, they're, like I say, 500,000 different kinds of these things, and some of them are parasitic, some of them live in the intestinal tract of animals, some of them, you know, parasitize plants, but they're tough little creatures. But the ones that you're using are the ones that are predatory toward problematic things, and they're just barely small enough. It's hard to see with the naked eye, but with the magnifying glass, you can generally see them pretty easily.
Okay. And y'all still have some more at your shop today?
We get a fresh shipment, you know, every day. If you want to call back on the nursery phone line, Sherry or Pat or whoever can run in and look in the refrigerator. Last time I looked, we did, but I have to tell you, in the spring in the nursery business, things change very quickly. So before you make the trip over, just call and ask them to put your name on a package or two, whatever you need, and we'll have them there for you when you make it.
All right. I appreciate it, sir.
Appreciate the call. Get out and have a great weekend. Let's see here. Greg, I guess it's about time. Let's get our last break of the show in, and we'll be back with more phone calls.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Boy, this 3 hours has gone by in a hurry. We've still got time for a number more phone calls, and then Dr. Kirby will be in, and we'll get to talk about pet health for an hour. Right now, Cindy and Tony are my next two callers, and Cindy is first. Good morning, Cindy. Hi, Cindy. Are you there, Cindy?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Okay, I hear you loud and clearly now. How can I help?
Yes. I have a couple questions. I snagged some canna seeds off of a dwarf yellow canna.
Okay.
And I have propagated them, and they're coming up. I want to know what's the likelihood I'm going to get the same thing.
Oh, that's a good question. you may get, the likelihood is that you will get something similar, but cannas, you know, they can be tall, they can be short, they can be green-leaved or they can be purple-leaved, and they can come in a wide range of colors. I would expect that you're probably going to get something that is a little bit bigger than what you started with, and I suspect it will be green-leaved. But as far as color, it's just going to be interesting to wait and see. It's fun. I don't think I've ever known anybody grown cannas from seed. They're normally propagated through tissue cutting, so maybe you'll have something new and valuable and beautiful that nobody's ever seen before.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. They're all coming up, every single one of them.
Wow, you've done well.
Yeah, it's great. They are green leaf, though, but I did.
Uh-huh.
I do want the dwarf because my plan it was to put some in the pond. So.
Well, and again, every single one of those plants is has unique genetics. So just you can tell once they really start growing, you can tell a little bit about the shape of a plant, even a young plant. And you can just select out the ones that look like they're going to be a little bit more compact. But at this point, just full sun, feed and water regularly. And it's probably going to take a full year before they'll be big enough to bloom. But you'll be able to tell the growth habit and at least select the ones that are going to reach the size you want. You'll be able to tell that within 3 or 4 months, but don't be at all surprised if it takes a year or even a 2 years for them to mature enough to produce flowers. That takes longer than just the growing.
Okay. But it's fun anyway.
Absolutely. And you've created something unique. And like I say, it's when, you know, and I made a few orchid hybrids back in, you know, my early career, and you have to know that the majority of them are going to probably be pretty much like the parents. Some of them are going to be worse, but you may get that 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 that turns out to be something new and brilliant and even valuable that people want to propagate and grow in the future.
Yeah. I can name it Cindy's Canna.
You can name it anything you like, and we'll just call it CC for short. How's that?
Yeah. Okay, my other question is, we have a raised bed that is under a cedar elm, mm-hmm. so it does get bright light. It doesn't, in the about the 4 to 5 o'clock hour, it does get a little more sun coming in from the west, but we have planted some Japanese yews there. I totally lost them. Then I planted some sweet olives, and they're just struggling. I'm getting brown tips. I just cut off at least 6 inches of the tops of the branches that were dead. Any hints?
Well, brown tips on the leaves tell you something's going on with the roots. You've got some sort of root damage happening, and mm-hmm. that can be caused by being too wet or being too dry. Can be caused by, you know, something in the soil. I would say, well, the sweet olive will grow with half-day sun, so it's probably not a sun issue. What you're describing sounds most like the soil is staying too wet, like it's not drying out adequately between waterings. And that would be my first guess. But when you pulled up the yews that didn't do well, had the roots spread out beyond the root ball, or is it just the same root ball that was there when you put them in the ground?
I wish I knew that answer.
Well, just remember, a little bit of Super Thrive is always a good idea. It's the best anti-shock material that I've ever seen. And I like it as a root simulator and starter when you transplant things, or if plants are at all stressed, and it sounds like for whatever reason these are a bit stressed, I would use just like a cap full of Super Thrive to a gallon of water. I would use that now. I would use it again in about a month. I would not rely on a sprinkler system. I would water them by hand, and I would water them very, very thoroughly when you water. I would get down and stick your finger in the soil. I wouldn't water again until that soil's dry about an inch deep. You do those things, and I think you will very definitely see, you know, an improvement in the health and in the growth. There's no reason sweet olive should not grow in the shade of a cedar elm. And raised bed, hopefully, you know, you got good soil in there. So that pretty much narrows it down to something's going on in the care they're getting. And my suspicion is that they're maybe getting watered too often, but not thoroughly enough when they're watered. So get some Super Thrive, treat them with Super Thrive now, do it again in 2 to 4 weeks, and let's talk again in a month or 6 weeks and see how that new growth looks.
Well, I hate to tell you that I've already done the Super Thrive, and I've done it a month apart, and I put on a bubbler to water it. Mm-hmm. I know that when we dug the hole, there was some roots in there.
Uh-huh.
And so roots of the cedar elm, likely. And yep. I know that, you know, it's planted a little bit higher than normal.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I thought that would be better.
Yeah, how often are you watering?
I was trying to do every third day. I say three times a week.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you that's probably a little too often. Yeah, okay. Use that index finger. Don't water until it's dry about an inch down. And kind of overcast, cloudier weather we've had, we haven't had a lot of real windy weather. I'm going to be surprised if you really need to water more than once a week. Now, when we get hotter, when we get windier, when we get sunnier, that will change. But and you know, the water doesn't hurt anything, but when the soil stays too wet, and especially if it's in a little heavier soil, the water drives the oxygen out of the soil. When that happens, your little fine root hairs start to die, and when that happens, you start getting the brown tips, the lackluster growth, and just sort of call it a plant lethargy or something like that. But continue to water thoroughly, but be sure you can stick that finger way down in there and let it go till it's dry before you water again.
Okay. Yeah, I did put some compost around it when I was planting just to make sure that, you know, the soil was a little looser.
Yeah. But my guess is not long enough between waterings. And I'd use the Super Thrive again. You're never going to overdo it. And let's watch for some new growth and see how it looks.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're certainly welcome. Next in line is Tony. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning. Bob, we got all these worms out here in the country that I don't think they're the woolly bears. They're black with a brown underneath and little gray ones and little tan ones, but good thing is they're eating all the weeds in the field, but they're also eating my collards. My collards look like they've been shot with buckshot.
Yeah, and that's probably a little green one. There are two ways to go after them. Spinosad, if you get it directly on the caterpillar, will kill it within a few minutes, and it's perfectly safe for you. If you want to have something long-lasting, get what they call BT or Bacillus thuringiensis. Be sure to add about a tablespoon of molasses to it when you mix it with water. Collards and lots of things in that family tend to have very slick leaves, so it doesn't stick real well, but it will still stay on the leaves. And normally one application of your BT will last for several weeks, and you can do both. If it were mine, I probably would go out and try to spray pretty thoroughly with the spinosad soap, and then I'd follow up the next day with a little BT just as a general spray over the area, and that'll take care of every caterpillar known to man.
Okay.
Okay, I can barely hear you. Go ahead.
I say, are the collards good to eat? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just wash them. But neither spinosad nor BT are harmful to you. Just rinse them good and cook them up to where you can't see the holes in them, and they'll be just fine.
Yeah. They're just religious now. I guess they're holy, huh?
Just be sure you wash all the caterpillar poop off of them. And that would be the only reason that would they be a little less appetizing, but I think you'll find that they're just fine.
Okay. And that, yeah, I got this Crawford lettuce that reseeds.
Uh-huh.
And a few of the seeds came up in the bed where my onions are. And, uh-huh. you know, they I hadn't seen a worm on those. Is there a way to smush the onions and get onion juice and spray that?
I don't think it'd do you a lot of good because that wouldn't slow the caterpillars down at all. Just when you make up your BT spray, go ahead and spray. Onions get their own kind of little black and yellow caterpillar that can tunnel out the leaves and, you know, do a lot of different things. And, of course, lettuce, you may get some other issues like pill bugs like lettuce, as do snails and slugs. So be vigilant. But I'd probably just make a general spraying with your BT just to be sure you knock out all the caterpillars before they can damage your new lettuce. Now, keep in mind that as it gets hotter, Crawford or any other lettuce will get bitter. So you're probably not going to be picking into the summer, but the kind of weather we're having right now is just absolutely perfect. Had some homegrown lettuce for supper last night, as a matter of fact, and it was really delicious.
Okay, and the azomite, the micronized, how do you keep it? What's the best way to keep it stirred up?
Just keep shaking as you go. If you're doing a hand sprayer or a sprayer on the end of the hose, just keep swishing it back and forth, and that'll generally keep it plenty agitated to go through the sprayer.
Okay, and we got a oak tree full of bees, and they're not finding the garden. They found me the other day when I tried to start the tractor, but they're not making their way to the garden. Would a bowl of honey help out there, maybe?
Well, not necessarily honey, but sugar water. You know, same sort of solution you make for your hummingbird feeders, about one part sugar to about four or five parts water.
Yeah.
Put it in just a plant saucer and, you know, give them a rock or a stick or a sponge or something like they can get on so that they're not getting down into the solution and drowning. But that generally, and in just about the same strength as you would do for a hummingbird feeder, that will usually draw them in just fine. Long term, go to a good nature store, Wild Birds Unlimited, or somewhere like that, and you can actually get a little mason bee thing that they will colonize. Mason bees are solitary bees, and they tend to nest in hollow tubes. I mean, they sometimes plug up our wind chimes. The little thing you can get at a nature store will look like a bunch of soda straws sacked one on the other. The mason bees are actually better pollinators than the honeybees, and they're not suffering nearly as many problems. So you might want to locate one of those somewhere around your garden sometime.
I made one of those on your advice with a 6x6 feeder block. And the ants got to it, the wood ants or whatever they were. But anyway, I'll figure something out.
Use one of those little ant traps like you put under a hummingbird feeder, something like a little umbrella you can fill with water. And hang it out in a shady area, and the mason bees will find it.
Okay. Did you get a call yesterday about Bruce Dooley?
I believe somebody was calling about Bruce, and to the best of my knowledge, Bruce is going strong. I know he's doing a podcast. And you can just go to natureapproved.com. I think that's still his website, and keep up with him. So far as I know, he's got eye issues, so he doesn't get out as much as he once did. But his mind still works fine, and his sense of humor, and twisted as it may be, is still intact. So if you talk to him, tell him I said hello. We're just out of time. Dr. Kirby's coming in. We'll talk your pet's health here on KTSA Radio San Antonio.